Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Michael McPherson, Interim Executive Director with Veterans for Peace, who talks about the current healthcare scandal at the Veterans Administration and the real cost of U.S. wars. Palestinian farmer Daoud Nassar, who discusses the Israeli military's recent destruction of 1,500 fruit trees on his Tent of Nations farm, representative of the treatment many Palestinians endure in the occupied territories. And Harley Geiger of the Center for Democracy and Technology, who examines recent revisions weakening the USA Freedom Act, legislation originally proposed to end NSA bulk collection of Americans' communications data. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Gulf state of Qatar has pledged to overhaul its migrant labor policy in the wake of reports of dangerous conditions for workers on construction projects related to the upcoming 2022 World Cup Games. In 2012 and 2013, over 900 migrant workers from Nepal, India, and Bangladesh died, mostly while doing construction work. Qatari authorities promised to abolish the controversial kafala sponsorship system, which ties migrant workers to single employers who have frequently been reported to abuse workers without fear of punishment from the state. The promises of labor reform came after a Qatar-funded report by the London law firm DLA Piper concluded the kafala system is no longer an appropriate tool for the effective control of migration. The official report on migrant labor is consistent with investigations by The Guardian newspaper, Human Rights Watch, and Amnesty International on the high number of deaths among migrant construction workers who are building infrastructure for the 2022 World Cup. The global headquarters of Spotify is tucked away in a drab office complex in downtown Stockholm, Sweden. The free music streaming service has rocked the music industry and made illegal music downloads irrelevant. Spotify, emerging as a small startup in 2008, has grown to reach 28 million music fans in 56 countries. In recent years, Sweden's egalitarian entrepreneurial culture produced the retail clothing giant H&M and the furniture superstore IKEA. With its strong welfare state, the average Swede pays much higher taxes than the average American, but enjoys important free benefits such as universal child care, pensions, comprehensive health care, and state-funded university education. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the five Nordic countries with 26 million people are the world's most egalitarian states, while the United States, Mexico, and Israel rank highest in inequality among industrialized nations. The hybrid economic model that combines a sophisticated and generous welfare state with private enterprise has had great success for many decades. Nordic nations now top the Global Innovation Index, which measures a country's infrastructure, business environment, and emerging technology. Since the passage of HB 2, the anti-abortion law in Texas, over a dozen reproductive health clinics have closed their doors and imposed new waiting periods for women seeking to end their pregnancies. Now, in much of Texas, women must travel hundreds of miles and sleep overnight, sometimes in a bus shelter, to visit a woman's clinic. According to the newspaper In These Times, volunteers from the Houston-based clinic Access Support Network are reaching out to women who arrive from out of town but are not prepared for the state-mandated two-day waiting period between their consultation and the abortion procedure. Angie Hayes, who runs the support network, describes a growing number of situations where women will arrive by bus, unprepared for an extended stay in Houston, with no toiletries or change of clothes, let alone a hotel room to stay for several days. The Fifth District Federal Appeals Court in New Orleans upheld the Texas law last October, saying the legislation did not create an undue burden on the right to an abortion, since 20 women's clinics remain open. Cecilia Richards of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America fears a new wave of restrictions on reproductive rights, stating, "We are fearful that women in vast stretches of the country are in real danger of losing the ability to access legal abortion safely." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
The scandal at the Veterans Administration has been building for some time. Over the past 2 to 3 years, the VA has seen an increase of 1.5 million patients, 200,000 of them soldiers returning from American wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Across the country, the Pentagon's healthcare system has found it difficult to treat the flood of veterans suffering from both physical injuries, including amputees, and those suffering with traumatic brain injuries requiring intensive care. The current media spotlight on the VA has focused on 40 veterans who reportedly died while waiting for care in Arizona and allegations that secret lists were kept to avoid accountability for thousands of vets who sometimes waited months to get an appointment, tests, or treatment. Sam Foote, a retired doctor of internal medicine at the Phoenix VA, exposed the scandal when he gave an Arizona Republic reporter details about the secret waiting lists and vets who had died. There's bipartisan anger in Washington that veterans aren't getting the treatment they deserve, prompting many Republicans to demand the firing of President Obama's Veterans Affairs Secretary Eric Shinseki. But while it's apparent that parts of the VA system are broken, requiring aggressive oversight and repair, it's also clear that some politicians are exploiting the scandal for political gain. Democrats have charged that many Republicans are hypocrites on veterans issues, pointing out that 41 GOP senators blocked a vote on a landmark veterans appropriations bill in February. That legislation, sponsored by Vermont's independent Senator Bernie Sanders, would have provided funds to improve and expand health and dental care, establish 27 new clinics and medical facilities, and support education and employment programs. Your reporter spoke with Michael McPherson, interim executive director with the group Veterans for Peace, who talks about the current VA healthcare scandal and the real cost of U.S. wars.
We think that the primary cause for the disaster in care is more than a decade of war. And of course, you know, we need to look at what's going on with the Veterans Administration, the inefficiencies, abuses, look at funding. You know, we need to look at all of that. Of course we do. However, it's the number of veterans, the number of people who have come back after all this time. And even with the increase in funding going from $100 billion to over $154 billion, the VA has not been able to keep up with the masses of veterans that have returned, and they've made it easier for Vietnam veterans also to make claims based on Agent Orange and other ailments. So when you add those people in as well, the VA has become overrun, and they haven't been able to keep up.
So there's a lot of discussion of underfunding, as you said, mismanagement. But you're saying the key issue really is the numbers of veterans that have been produced by these two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as Vietnam-era veterans who are now claiming the treatment that's been awarded to them for right. The legacy of Agent Orange and other problems that they suffer as a result of chemical warfare that occurred in Southeast Asia. So it's, right. It's the numbers you're saying is key.
Yes, I'm saying the numbers, but the numbers are a result of bad foreign policy. The numbers are a result of using force and war as a means to solve problems. Or, as we also see, that people are greedy. War profiteers making money, knowing that if they put certain politicians and put forth certain policies so that we can create war so they'll make money, or politicians looking for power by using warfare as a means to build their resume. So it's a matter of policy and attitude about, well, how do we solve these problems? Now, let me be clear. I'm not saying that everyone who believes war is the answer for certain problems is a profiteer, you know, or greedy or searching for power, because many people believe that war is a necessary evil. And in one point in my life, I believed that myself. So I'm not trying to paint that kind of brush on everyone. However, I would ask people to really look at, especially the last decade of war, but if you even look at the history of the Vietnam War, because and bringing that back up, because part of the problem is that we have so many veterans from that war as well, putting pressure on the VA. The U.S. really has not been defending us as a country as much as it has been forwarding a policy that expands U.S. dominance and, you know, U.S. presence around the world. So what we believe is that it is the foreign policy and how we're going about conducting ourselves in the world that's causing this. We need to stop creating veterans who have post-traumatic stress, who have traumatic brain injury, you know, all these ailments. And then you wouldn't have this kind of pressure on the VA.
Michael, in your view, what is the solution here, at least in the short run, for right. getting veterans the treatment they need and deserve? You hear a lot of discussion among politicians about firing former General Shinseki, who's the Secretary of Veterans Affairs under the Obama right. administration. That in of itself is not a solution. But what should be done, do you think, right now?
Well, you know, we, at this point in VFP, we're not taking a stand on General Shinseki, whether or not he should or shouldn't be fired. I think clearly we would say that he is not at the root of the problem. Of course, being in charge, that does mean that he has responsibility and has to be held accountable. And I know that the president is waiting, they're waiting for certain reports to come back and everything. But before I get into what some of the things that can be done, we know this is not a new problem. So when they say they're waiting for reports and things to come back, we've been talking about these issues for, you know, a decade ourselves, calling into question many things, including the sexual assault and rape that's been going on, which is not part of this VA question. But I think it speaks to how soldiers and troops are treated, and that has been going on for at least a decade, and we're still at the same situation with that question. And we have suicide rates of troops or veterans that are estimated to be 22 a day, and that's been going on forever. So when we look at this scandal, as some might call it at this moment, we need to be clear that none of this is anything new and that this has been going on for a very long time. In terms of the VA itself, they really need to get in there and hold these people accountable for the doctoring these documents and not reporting actually what's happening. And then maybe they can develop what systems they need to put into place to make these waiting lists not as long. But the thing is, people have to be truthful. And one of the reasons I'm sure many of the listeners have been in a situation where you have so much pressure put on you that you feel like you might have to fudge the books some. And some people will actually do that. Others will have the integrity not to. So they're going to have to develop a system that rewards instead of punishes you for telling the truth. You need a system that rewards you for uncovering problems, not punishing you for uncovering problems.
That was Michael McPherson, Interim Executive Director with Veterans for Peace. Find links to news and analysis of the VA scandal on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On May 19th, the Israeli military entered the Nassar family farm a few miles outside of Bethlehem in the West Bank and bulldozed more than 1,500 mature apricot and apple trees that were almost ready for harvest. The family has been battling in Israeli courts to hold on to their 100-acre farm, which is surrounded by illegal Israeli settlements. Despite having all the paperwork documenting their ownership of the land going back almost a century, Israel claims the property is state land. In 2010, the family was served with 13 demolition orders, which they are fighting in court. The Nassar farm is known as the Tent of Nations because the family has nurtured peaceful relations with their neighbors and with Israeli and international supporters. The Israeli military's action at the Nassar farm came less than a week before Pope Francis visited the Middle East in nearby Bethlehem, where the pontiff openly supported Palestinians' pursuit of an independent state, said a short prayer alongside a section of Israel's controversial separation wall, and invited Palestinian and Israeli leaders to the Vatican to pray for peace. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Dawood Nassar, who lives on the farm with his wife and children and other relatives. He was traveling in the U.S. on one of his regular speaking tours when his wife called to inform him of the destruction of the fruit orchard. Dawood said this was the first attack by the Israeli military or settlers since 2002, and that despite the high emotional and financial cost of losing so many trees, the family and its supporters will replant and continue to pursue legal remedies.
2 months ago, they declared the area where the trees, the fruit trees, were planted as a state land. And, of course, it's a private property. And we appealed on the 12th of May. But unusually, after after the lawyer appeals, we get a court date. But what happened is they came on the 19th and destroyed. So even without waiting for a court date. So, yeah, it's very difficult. It's a very difficult situation for us. But we are trying now to go legally and try to raise this question, why did they do it, although the land is a private property? I believe, you know, they are trying, you know, in different ways to move us out of the area.
Are you going to ask for compensation?
Well, we will, of course, and this is something that we will never get, but this is important to react legally and ask for compensation, of course.
Dawood Nasser, thousands of people, internationals and also Israelis, have come to work on the farm. Do you know if there's been any response to this inside Israel?
Well, you know, I got many emails from Jewish people and Israeli people who are very shocked to hear this. And, of course, they are supporting us. And, you know, they said also when you start replanting the trees, new trees, we are ready to come and help you with that. You know, it's good to feel the support also from the other side. There are people who believe in justice, and they don't like what is happening in their names.
Will you replant trees? And if so, the financial cost must be high, as well as the emotional cost of this attack.
First step is to inform people to react, you know, internationally. And the second part is to appeal and go on a legal battle there, and of course asking for compensation and all of that. And the third step is to you know, to cultivate the area because it's damaged, to build the natural wall, the terraces again, and then prepare the ground to be planted by December or January, this coming December or January. You know. So the planting season is in the rainy season. And it is a big loss. You know. Of course, it's emotionally, it's huge, but also like trying now to replant and to rebuild and so on, it is also a huge burden on us too.
It seems with the relationships you've built around the world, this might become a better-known incident than the daily occurrences of uprooting of trees in Palestine, and also because of the extent of it. Do you think the Israeli military might think in retrospect that this wasn't such a great idea, given the response to it?
I hope so, but not only because of the response, because also it's unjust, you know, even according to their system. Because the moment you appeal, usually they are not allowed to act this way until the court decides. And, you know, like with our situation now, they did not wait for a decision. They came and they smashed the trees without even a notice. Okay, this is going to happen, you know. And this is what our lawyer said. This is a reaction, illegal, even according to their system, you know. And that's why it's important to go to court and try to solve it also legally, you know. And, of course, the international awareness and pressure is important and needed in this way. Taking into consideration that this is an example of what is happening all over the Palestinian territories. You know, it's not like a unique story, but we want people to raise this question, why it happened to the Tent of Nations, but also inform indirectly about what is happening in general. You know, this is happening, illegal action, and illegal action must be stopped by court. And hopefully, you know, justice will prevail. We have to continue this struggle with faith, with love, and hope. You know, we cannot change our way of action.
That was Dawood Nasser of Tent of Nations Farm in the West Bank. For more perspectives on Israel's treatment of Palestinians living in the occupied territories, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Following former NSA contractor Edward Snowden's revelations about the government's warrantless dragnet surveillance of Americans' communications, the public became increasingly apprehensive about potential abuses in the nation's post-9/11 intelligence programs. In response to growing concern about privacy rights, a bipartisan group in Congress turned their attention to drafting legislation that would limit the government's ability to gather Americans' communications data. To that end, Representative Jim Sensenbrenner, Republican of Wisconsin, an original sponsor of the USA Patriot Act, introduced a new bill known as the USA Freedom Act. The Freedom Act was originally designed to rein in the dragnet collection of data by the National Security Agency and other government programs by amending Section 215 of the Patriot Act. The proposed bill would have ensured that any phone records obtained by the government were essential in an investigation that involved terrorism or espionage, thereby ending bulk collection while preserving the intelligence community's ability to gather information in a more focused way. However, the Obama administration and some congressional leaders opposed many of these proposed changes, and when the Freedom Act was sent to the House Rules Committee, the bill was quickly stripped of key provisions that limited government action. These changes led many legislators who originally supported the measure to oppose it, believing that it would actually codify NSA dragnet surveillance. The bill passed the House on May 22nd and now moves to the U.S. Senate. Your reporter spoke with Harley Geiger, senior counsel with the Center for Democracy and Technology, who discusses the revisions weakening the USA Freedom Act and how the public can influence the outcome when the bill is next debated in the Senate.
This is a bill that we had supported for well over a year. Same thing with some of the larger technology companies. I believe that Google and Twitter and probably others had publicly endorsed the USA Freedom Act, which is not entirely common to have technology companies and technology civil liberties advocates on the same page on something as sensitive as national security. But the consensus was that the government had gone just way too far in its interpretation and its actions. So the bill took a long time before it finally reached the next stage in the legislative process, at least in the House of Representatives, which is a markup. And it went to the House Judiciary. That was the committee of its primary jurisdiction. And there the committee amended it in several ways. And they amended that ban, that prohibition on bulk collection. And they changed the structure of it pretty radically. Much of the weight, much of the teeth in the prohibition on a dragnet came to rest on a particular phrase. And that phrase is specific selection term, which I know sounds very wonky. But basically it means that at the time it was defined to be a term that uniquely describes a person or an entity or an account. And what that means then is that when the government goes to the surveillance court, to the FISA court, and says, you know, the government wants to get information, they have to describe as the basis for production, as the way that they're getting the information, they have to describe a person, an entity, or an account. And so we thought that this, although different and not entirely clear, it was still a little ambiguous because entity is somewhat ambiguous. We still thought that although this was different than the original USA Freedom, this was still a relatively effective ban on bulk collection. And then after the House Judiciary markup, it made its way ultimately to the Rules Committee. A lot of people had never even heard of the Rules Committee, but it's an extraordinarily powerful committee, and it basically determines in what form and how many amendments and how much debate different bills will reach the floors. And it's the last stop before a bill goes to the House floor for a vote. It's heavily partisan. It's weighted very much in favor of the party that's in the majority, and it is usually handpicked by the Speaker of the House of Representatives. So when this bill went to the Rules Committee, that key term, that key phrase that so much of the bulk collection ban rested on was altered again dramatically. And this is where it really was really, really weakened. So whereas previously it said that the unique selection term must uniquely describe a person, entity, or account, full stop, now it said a specific selection term is a discrete term that the government uses to place a limit on the scope of information sought. And it gave a couple of examples, such as a person, entity, account, device, and or address. And no one really knows what that means entirely. No one is entirely sure what that authorizes or prohibits. And that's the point. The definition was changed from a relatively clear and exclusive list, a cabined definition, to something that is deliberately ambiguous, open-ended, and exploitable. What it boils down to now is it says that there just needs to be some limit, just some limit on the scope of the information that the government seeks. So what we interpret this to mean, again, it's not entirely clear, this is a whole new law, but based on our interpretation of it, and this is shared by many of the other people in this space, if the government wants to get nationwide information, it probably cannot. It's probably banned by this bill because there's not really any limits. But if the government wanted to get, for example, citywide or statewide information, so it said, the government said, I would like to get the email records of everybody in Salt Lake City, Utah. Now, that is a limit. It is a limit on the scope of information as compared to nationwide surveillance. So at that point, once the bill incorporated these provisions, the civil liberties groups, tech companies, all withdrew their support of the bill because it continued to authorize, in our opinion, unacceptably high levels, unacceptably sweeping levels of surveillance.
What is Plan B among the legislators who are disappointed by the changes in the USA Freedom Act? And is there a possibility another bill can be raised? There's still the Senate to go through, and I know that could take a while to describe what's going to happen there. But what is Plan B?
Well, Plan B is the Senate. The next stage of this is the Senate. All eyes are towards the Senate right now to see whether it would be possible to improve that language, to improve that very crucial term that I had described earlier. That is what the best chance that we've got now for reform. That being said, there are many calls for additional legislation, additional bills that address other parts of the surveillance. This really just addresses a couple of programs that we know of, egregious programs, but it's certainly, USA Freedom was never intended to be a bill that fixed everything that was wrong with NSA mass surveillance.
And one important element in all this is the input of citizens. What, in your view, is the most effective thing people can do who are concerned about NSA surveillance of Americans' phone and internet and other communications? What can they do at this juncture to have an effective voice of what happens with this legislation?
The best thing that people can do is to call their senators, especially if your senator is on the Judiciary Committee, particularly senators in Texas and Minnesota, but several others. Right now, the best thing is to call your senators and to say that you want a USA Freedom that actually protects your privacy and not something that is watered down, that you would like something stronger than what the House passed, because what the House passed, we believe, will still enable mass surveillance.
That was Harley Geiger, senior counsel with the Center for Democracy and Technology. Find more news and commentary on NSA surveillance and efforts to end abuses by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikita. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.